All right, so thanks very much to the organizers for organizing this conference and inviting me to speak here. I was given the topic of galaxy surveys, which is too broad to cover in 30 minutes, so I've specialized to the cosmic distance scale, and most of the examples I'm going to give are data from SDSS. I'll try to mention some other surveys as I go along. So the primary motivation for this is the topic of dark energy, which pushes us to measure cosmic distance and the behavior of gravity at large scales to very high precisions. And so the outline of the talk, I'm going to be introducing the Baryon acoustic oscillations as a standard ruler, trying to explain some of the linear theory pedagogy and also what happens in nonlinear structure formation. I expect that some of you will have seen this material, but I think probably not everybody, so I wanted to go through that. I'll then describe this idea of reconstruction and describe how we've been applying this in both SDSS2 and SDSS3. And I'll end with some cosmology results from SDSS3. Anja is going to give the next talk and describe the BAO and the Lyman alpha force in a lot more than I'll say, but I'll just put in a couple teasers there. And then I'll end with some discussion of the future. As we go to the acoustic oscillations, the name suggests sound waves, and indeed there are sound waves that propagate in the early universe. If you think about this from the point of view of a toy model, every initial overdension, which is in adiabatic perturbations and overdensity both in gas and dark matter and photons, is also an overpressure, and that overpressure launches a spherical sound wave. The sound wave travels out until the epoch of recombination at relativistic speeds. At early on, it's 57% of the speed of light. And when you reach the epoch of recombination, the photons decouple from the gas and come to us as the microwave background, but the baryons sit in this ring 150 megaparsecs away from the initial dark matter lump, and both of those regions now preferentially attract more material and preferentially form galaxies, and so we have the prediction that galaxies and all matter at late times should have this characteristic separation of 150 megaparsecs. So that's the signal that we're going to look for. The reason that it's so useful from the point of view of dark energy is that the scale of 150 megaparsecs is very easy physics. It's just the distance that the sound waves could travel prior to recombination. And that depends on only two factors, the speed of sound and the amount of time you have to propagate. The speed of sound depends upon the ratio of pressure to inertia in the fluid, which we usually write as the baryon to photon ratio, or omega BH squared. And the amount of time you have to propagate depends on how much time the universe spends in the radiation-dominated epoch compared to the matter-dominated epoch. That depends upon the matter-to-radiation ratio, which we usually write as omega matter H squared, on the assumption that there's no exotic relativistic degrees of freedom. So once you measure these two, then you get this distance of 150 megaparsecs very precisely. And the marvelous thing is that the microwave background anisotropies, the relative heights of the peaks and troughs in the power spectra, allows us to measure exactly these two quantities. With WMAP, this predicted the sound horizon to 1% precision. With the first Planck results, I think it was about 0.3 to 0.4 precision. And I think we hope that we'll do slightly better by the end of the Planck mission. So it's a wonderful thing. The universe has given us a very precise standard ruler to a fraction of a percent. And we can now go out and try to measure this in our surveys. So as you know, in cosmology, distances can be complicated. And in detail, there's really two different ways you can measure distance in such a thing. So we can measure along the line of sight, in which case our characteristic scale will map to a separation redshift according to the local Hubble parameter. Or we can measure it across the line of sight on the plane of the sky, in which case the scale maps to a characteristic angle according to the angular diameter distance. So in principle, by measuring surveys at a variety of redshifts, we can actually map out the Hubble parameter and the angular diameter distance as a function of redshift. So we just need to go out and measure the universe in three dimensions. And a popular way to do this is with galaxy redshift surveys. And as you know, there are complications in galaxy surveys from a number of things. We've been talking about small perturbations up till now, but of course, the real perturbations are not small. We want to measure the mass, but instead we're measuring the light, and there could be differences between those two. And we're trying to measure relative distances to things, but we're really measuring redshifts, and the conversion from redshift to distance involves the peculiar velocities. So all of these factors partially degrade the acoustic peak measurements. But it turns out the systematics are quite small, and it's because these are still very large scales. And so although things are getting moved around a bit, they're not washing out this overall 150 megaparsec scale. So when we think about nonlinear structure formation, this acoustic signature is really encoded in pairs of galaxies that are separated by 150 megaparsecs. But the material that began at 150 megaparsecs is getting jostled around by the large-scale structure formation in the universe, the large-scale velocity fields. And so what started off at 150 megaparsecs might end up at 140 or 160. This takes what was initially a sharper peak and tends to broaden it out. That's shown here on this graph, that going to low redshift, you're just broadening out this acoustic scale. This is unfortunate because it makes the scale harder to measure. So you're reducing the contrast in the peak. It does not by itself indicate a bias in the measurement. To get a bias in the measurement, you have to characteristically take the objects that were 150 megaparsecs and characteristically move them in or characteristically move them out. This can happen. You know, you would say, overdensities attract, so everything should move in. But because we're looking at two-point functions, the underdensities count equally, and the underdensities tend to repel. And so to first order, this tends to cancel. Doesn't cancel perfectly, and in simulations we'll see that we do get shifts somewhat below 0.5%. So when we run big in-body simulations and measure the acoustic peak carefully, we get the following shifts in the acoustic scale, which reach about 0.3% at redshift zero. This by itself is not that bad. You can really predict this very well. We can predict it from simulations. We can predict it from perturbation theory. These answers agree. And so in principle, you would just predict these shifts and subtract them off as a simple perturbative analysis. But it turns out that we'll be able to do better than that. So the degradation at nonlinear scales is really being driven by these large-scale flows. And these flows are produced by the gravitational forces of exactly the same overdensities that we're measuring in our map. So there's a way to go in and try to undo things. So basically, once you've measured the map of your galaxies, you can predict, you can see where the overdensities are on large scales, and you can predict what flows they would have created, and you can then try to move things backwards along those flows, and in so doing, restore the original linear picture. So this is just showing pictures of this where the blue line is what you get out of the simulations initially, and then if you just try to do a very simple sort of one step moving back, then you can get back to the magenta lines, which are pretty close to the black lines that went in. So even doing the simplest thing already allows you to undo a fair bit of the nonlinearity. And this is important one of the reasons it's important is that you're increasing the contrast of the peak, and therefore you're restoring the statistical precision that's available in the data set. So let me start back up here. Okay, so this is just going to be a little movie of this, where we're going to start with some central point, and then I've marked points in a simulation that are 150 megaparsecs away, and this red line is a circle that's 150 megaparsecs from the centroid of the blue points. So this Gaussian is just showing a representation of how far the black points are scattered from the red circle. So this is just a toy model. This is just doing Zeldovich approximation to try to show you what's going on. This thing does not, I'm not getting any cursor on the screen. Okay. So as the universe starts to form, I don't know if this is gonna work very easily, okay. So as the universe starts to form, you can see that the large-scale flows are pulling the black points away from the circle. The circle is moving to stay centered on the 150 megaparsecs away from that centroid. And so the width of this dispersion is growing. That corresponds to decreasing the contrast of the peak. I'm just going to have to run this thing all the way through because I'm not getting any control of it. So now at the late times, you can now infer what the large scale flows are and now try to move things back only on large scales. And you'll see that just on, you know, you're not able to undo the small scale structure, but even on the large scales, if you just push things back, then you can move things back pretty close to the initial circle and get the peak to sharpen up. So that's just trying to illustrate the idea here of reconstruction. So when we do this in simulations, we do in fact find that this improves the precision of the acoustic scale. But what's very nice to see is that it also reduces the shift from the raw issue. So I showed you this plot before of the 0.3% shift. When we do reconstruction, it ends up debiasing down to 0%. In fact, this is an 0.02% calibration of the standard ruler. When we put on galaxy bias, the galaxy bias causes the overdensities and underdensities, which I said we're going to cancel, but now it's relabeling what's overdense and what's underdense, and so you throw off this cancellation a little bit. And as you go to more extreme bias models, again, you can get shifts relative to the initial case. Here's a shift of 0.5% or so. But when you put on reconstruction on the galaxy field, not on some new extra data set, then again, it tends to debias, and this goes to about 0.1%. When we do this on mock catalogs on the full CutSky SDSS2 data set, we find shifts of 0.1 plus or minus 0.15%. So really, this reconstruction technique has been able to standardize the ruler back to its initial state at a precision that's well below the statistical error bars of any current data set. So that's very nice. When we go to observe the BAO, you can worry about observational systematics in the clustering of galaxies. This is a very old topic. There's been lots of work in the literature about how to detect systematic errors, remove them or avoid them entirely. And in general, this application of the acoustic oscillations is easier than the general P of K. Because the acoustic oscillation signature is oscillatory in wave number, there's lots of effects in systematic clustering that can move tilt your entire spectrum or move your spectrum up and down, but always in a very broadband sense. And the fact that the acoustic oscillations are oscillating in wave number makes it considerably easier to marginalize against those kinds of systematics. So that turns out to be very nice. The other thing that's important to remember is that when we look at this length scale, we're trying to measure the location of this acoustic scale, but this is all tied to the measurements of angles and redshifts. So it is true that in astronomy we have trouble, some quantities are easier to measure than others, but in particular, angles and redshifts are the things that astronomers routinely do to a part in a million. This is really something that we can have very, very good control over, much, much better than 10 to the minus 3. Okay, so now let's turn to some data. So I'm going to be talking a lot about the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Many of you know about the SDSS. It's the world's largest galaxy redshift survey. We've been performing wide field imaging and spectroscopy of a large number of types of objects, galaxies, quasars, stars, and everything in between. And I'm going to actually be telling you about two different data sets which are more different than their numbering would imply. So let me explain. So DR7, this is the full data set from the original SDSS legacy survey. So this is including luminous red galaxies out to redshift of about 0.5. And then with SDSS3, we're really starting over on a new survey, same part of the sky, but really a completely different target selection. And DR9 is the first release of spectroscopy from SDSS3. And this includes galaxies out to redshift of 0.7. So these are two pretty different data sets, different redshift ranges. We, of course, worked on BAO throughout SDSS 1 and 2, and this culminated in analysis by Percival et al. And Reed et al. Of the SDSS 2 DR7 analysis with detections of the acoustic oscillations in the power spectrum. This yielded a 2.7% measurement of the distance to redshift 0.275. And when combined with WMAP5 and the supernova data of the time, this yielded H-naughts of 68 plus or minus 2, omega matter 0.29 plus or minus 0.02, very consistent with the models that we're still working with. 2011 was a good year with new detections of the BAO. This came from the WiggleZ project at the AAT, which was studying galaxies at higher redshift, typically about 0.6. This yielded about a 4% measurement. And also at low redshift from the 60F galaxy survey, a very wide field survey of the very local universe in the southern hemisphere, which gave a 4.5% measurement at redshift 0.1. And this meant that we now had a BAO Hubble diagram marching out from redshift 0.1 all the way up to 0.7, with measurements of the distance redshift relation. So in preparation for SDSS3, we went back to look at the SDSS2 data set to apply these new reconstruction techniques. And we found that this did produce a sharp improvement in the data set. So this is a picture of the correlation function stacking 160 mock catalogs. So this is far, far better signal to noise than we actually get in the data. But this is R squared times the correlation function, which highlights the acoustic scale here. This is distance across the line of sight and along the line of sight. So there's our ring. Now, that's in real space. In redshift space, you don't get to measure that. You measure this. So this large-scale infall towards overdense regions, the correlation between the velocity fields and the density fields leads to a very large change in this picture, where you can still see the ring, but there's clearly a very anisotropic signal here. And when we take the map and we estimate reconstruction, we're actually estimating these flows. And so we can, in addition to just trying to move things back to their initial location, we can also subtract off what we view as their large-scale peculiar velocity. And so when we do the reconstruction, we actually do restore a lot of the isotropy of the initial ring, and you can see, you know, a very sharp acoustic scale coming back in here. So this is, again, just a visualization of what reconstruction is doing. So before reconstruction, we had the following correlation function. This is R squared times the correlation function. You can see an acoustic feature here. This gave an error bar of 3.5%, and when we turn on reconstruction, we get that scale, and now the acoustic scale is sharpened up to 1.9%. This is equivalent to tripling the volume of the survey, which is a good thing because the project took 15 years and better part of $100 million, so tripling it is good. It's a lot of work avoided. Okay, so now moving on to SDSS3. This is the next phase of the SDSS project. We started in 2008. We're going to be continuing until summer of next year. In detail, SDSS3 has four different surveys. I'm going to be telling you about the data from the Barren Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey, BOSS, which is a redshift survey. We also have project aimed at the Milky Way, Segway 2, and Apogee, and a project aimed at radial velocity planet searching, so four different things. SDSS3 reused the original telescope but improved the instrumentation significantly. We're continuing with data releases. We've already had two data releases, DR8 and DR9. We're preparing for DR10 this summer, and support from many different places, including 50 different member institutions listed here. So a bit of an eye chart, but lots of institutions involved in SDSS3. So I'm going to focus here on Barren Oscillation Spectroscopic Survey. This intends to be a comprehensive study of the low redshift barren acoustic oscillation, and in general, the best large-scale structure sample yet. So SDSS3 is featuring 10,000 square degrees of spectroscopy, 1.5 million spectra of massive galaxies out to redshift about 0.75. So this is a picture of the number density, co-moving number density versus redshift, where this pink region here is what was done before with SDSS2, but now the blue and the red here are what's being done with SDSS3. I think this kind of undersells the project because really, you know, linear and redshift doesn't tell you about the volume. So if you scale instead to enclosed volume, you can see what an improvement SDSS3 is going to be above what SDSS2 was able to do. In addition to the galaxies, we have a major sample of quasars, which I'm going to leave it to Anja to explain, but there's really a very large number of quasars, and the intent here is to look at the Lyman Alpha Forest through, you're really making a three-dimensional picture of the high redshift intergalactic medium from the Lyman Alpha Forest. So the survey is now 80% complete. We have over 1 million spectra in hand. I'm going to be telling you about results only from the first third of the survey, which this has this fairly unfilled geometry on the sky. But by now, basically, this entire inner part's been filled in, and we're just working on the last little bit at high declination. So the survey is very close to done. Furthermore, I'm only going to be working on the high redshift part of the sample, going from 0.43 to 0.75. But when we did this, we found a very clear detection of the acoustic peak. So this was the correlation function that came out of BOSS. We did a very extensive analysis both in correlation function and power spectra. Those results agreed pretty well. And we measured the distance to redshift 0.57 to 1.7% precision. So this was the first major BAO result from SDSS3. an obvious thing to do is to compare it to the result from redshift 0.35. And so the BOSS points are in black, the SDSS2 points are in red. The offset vertically is just because the BOSS galaxies are more numerous and therefore live in less massive halos and therefore have less bias. So that's what you expect. But you can see a very nice agreement in the acoustic, in the shape and the scale of the acoustic feature. So these are in very good agreement. The BOSS detection itself was over 5 sigma, which was the first for a BAO, a single experiment BAO detection. Combining with SDSS2, the detection was over 6.5 sigma. This is a little bit of a funny statistic because, of course, we've already detected this at, you know, whatever it is, 100 sigma or 5,000 sigma, I don't know, in the microwave background. So there's no question that the BAO exists in the universe. The question is, what scale is it at? That's a slightly different question, but again, very high precision on that now. So we have a Hubble diagram. This is now distance versus redshift for 6DF, SDSS2, BOSS, and WiggleZ. This is really nice to see. Over plotted is the prediction from the WMAP data, assuming a flat lambda CDM cosmology. So very limited choice here, but you can see it goes through the data extremely well. The Planck version also goes through the data extremely well. I'll show that in a minute here. So zooming in, if you divide through by the best fit or by the predicted WMAP value, then you get these values. So very consistent with the WMAP data, but in detail, it was pulling a little bit high. And so if you move the WMAP omega matter A squared up by 1 sigma, then you get the dashed line, which was our best fit to that data. That was really nice. The Planck team, of course, found that omega matter A squared went up. So this actually came into even better agreement. So here's the version of this plot from the Planck paper 16. And it goes exactly through the BOSS point. But again, very highly consistent with all the BAO data to date, and shrinking the prediction region by about a factor of 2. Moving back to the WMAP view of this, this is just overplotting the measurements from the supernova experiments. If you take the SNLS data, fit it out in some higher dimensional, in some dark energy model with a fair number of degrees of freedom as well as curvature, and just ask what does that predict for the redshift, the distance redshift relation, you get this blue swath normalizing to the BOSS point. But again, you can see that the supernova distance redshift relation and the BAO distance redshift relation are in very good agreement. In detail, the supernova have better relative distance errors by, you know, order a factor of 2 at this point. But of course, the supernovae aren't telling you where you live up and down in this plot. So the two really work well together. If you vary, this is again, the gray curve here is assuming flat lambda CDM, but if you vary the assumption of your low redshift cosmology, then you can change those predictions. So in particular, if you say, no, instead the universe is going to be open with an 0.01 curvature, then you move down to this blue swath, which you can see is rather different from the data. If instead you say, oh no, let's keep it flat but have W of minus 0.7, you would move to this curve, which again, fairly different from the data. So this is indicating the kind of cosmological leverage you can get. This is replacing the WMAP predictions with the Planck predictions for the same choice of cosmology. So this is great, right? We have a very detailed prediction from the CMB given assumptions of W and curvature. And now we can go and try to map this out and see if we agree. A point that I think is important to make is that the combination of microwave background acoustic oscillations and supernova is effectively producing a reverse distance ladder. So the CMB is calibrating the sound horizon at redshift of 1,000. The BAO is then measuring this at redshifts of order 0.5. And the supernova relative distances, just the relative flux of supernova, is moving that distance scale from redshift of 0.5 down to redshift 0. So the combinations of these three are actually giving you an inference of the distance scale at low redshift, and that is the Hubble constant. So we get strong constraints on the Hubble constant and omega matter independent of what we assume or what we allow to float about the curvature and equation of state basically, these are not model-dependent statements about H0 and omega matter. You really, or at least not in terms of low redshift model uncertainties. You really are moving all the way back from redshift of 1,000 to redshift 0. With WMAP 7, this gave us H0s of 70 plus or minus 2, omega matter 0.28 plus or minus 0.014. It's very, and this I should say here, these are now varying all the way from lambda CDM up to open W0 WA CDM. So really just lots of variation, and the error bars don't move. Because really, the supernovae are controlling the distance scale at low redshift. So of course, you then want to compare that to the H0 measurements, which today are not in that much tension. I mean, this is maybe 2 sigma, maybe 1.5 sigma. So this is not something to get particularly concerned about. But it's interesting. And if it turned out that in the future that this disagreement with H0 were to get sharpened up, then this could indicate new physics in the sound horizon. If you add relativistic degrees of freedom, then you actually change the inferences at high redshift about what the sound horizon is. And this can, in principle, move all these points relative to the H0 point. That would be great to discover. If you replace the WMAP data by the Planck data here, then you know this is I found this plot to be kind of fun because you can see the Planck prediction for flat lambda CDM, and you can see the supernova curve. And so you can start to see from this plot why it is that Planck plus supernova is tugging a little bit towards W not equal minus 1. You can see that it's pulling a little bit. That's just the statement that these slopes don't match. OK, not very significant, but you can sort of see it graphically here. And you can also see that, you know, I think the low redshift data is consistent with either of those two slopes. Yeah. But we'll see how this sharpens up. And you can also see here the mild level of disagreement between the local direct measurements of H0 and the prediction of Planck with flat lambda CDM. OK, moving on to anisotropic clustering. So of course, clustering should be isotropic in real space. That was this picture. If you use the wrong cosmology, then you'll create a net ellipticity between your line of sight direction and your transverse direction. This is commonly known as the Alcock-Pachinsky effect. And that basically corresponds to stretching this diagram and making it elliptical. So you'd love to detect this because you're able to measure this combination of angular diameter distance times h. In the context of the BAO ring, that might be something to measure. But in addition to the BAO ring, there's a lot more information down here at smaller scales if you can model it well. The challenge, of course, is that the universe has peculiar velocities, and those peculiar velocities are creating an order unity anisotropy in these clustering pictures. So if you want to remove the ellipticity, you've got to be able to handle the redshift distortions to very high precision. Somewhat less so for the BAO, but in general, you just got to be able to do this really well. So we want to be able to separate the two. They are formally not degenerate, but it's obviously some challenge. From the point of view of BAO, we've been able to detect the acoustic signature both in the transverse direction and the line of sight direction. So indeed, we can start to tease apart H and DA separately. The cosmological leverage from this at present is not very compelling. We get the following green curve in the line of sight distance scale versus the transverse distance scale, which at low redshift, there's no difference between these two. At redshift 0, there's no model predicts an Alcock-Pachinsky difference. So this is not, it only gets more interesting as you go to high redshift. I think it's much more interesting in Lyman alpha 4, so I'm sure Anja's going to talk about that. So that's the place to look for this, but we wanted to start here. This is only BAO. Yes, thank you for clarifying. One thing that was really, I think, very important about this plot in this paper is that it really validates the use of this dV parameter as an appropriate compression of the data. And what by that I mean that the green curve is really nicely encapsulated by the blue curve, which is a constant dV. That was not a priori obvious that that would work. And that's a nice validation. I'm running out of time, so I'm actually going to skip through a couple points here. But there's been work on smaller scales trying to separate out the Alcock-Pachinsky effect from the growth of structure. This is not unique to SCSS3. There's been work in other surveys as well. And this is just a big growth industry. It is more modeling dependent, but it's a big opportunity. So I think people are very excited about doing this work. OK, Anja's going to talk about the Lyman alpha force. I'm just going to say here that we were very excited this past year to get a first detection of the BAO in the Lyman alpha force. This is a precision distance measurement now at redshift of 2. I'm going to leave all the details to Anja, but this was really exciting to see. One of the nice things about this is now you can look at the Hubble parameter divided by 1 plus z. That's literally the acceleration or the velocity that two test particles in the universe are relative to one another. And of course, this is the familiar acceleration of the velocity at late time. But now with this BAO point at high redshift, we're actually able to get a very secure measurement that the universe was decelerating from redshift 2 to redshift 1. OK, so I've described work to date with SDSS-3. It's about a factor of 7 increase over SDSS-2. We're in the middle of the survey. There's a lot more to come in the next few years. But this is really only one of many projects that are going on or planned for the rest of this decade. A big one is HETDEX, which is going to be starting soon. This is now working at redshift 2. Ichiro's here. He can probably tell you much more about it. This is going to be a really exciting view of the universe, not just BAO, but lots of things at redshift of 2. And there's a lot of surveys planned for the rest of the decade. So EBOS, which is a part of SDSS-4, MS-DESI, Foremost, Weave, Samire, all big ground-based surveys to try to extend out to redshift 1 to 2 in BAO. There's the Euclid project, Euclid satellite mission, which is going to be doing of order 50 million galaxies at redshift 0.7 to 2. There's the WFIRST satellite mission to do a deeper survey over smaller areas. There's very exciting developments with 21 centimeters, not here at redshift 6, but now we're talking about redshifts 1 to 3. And I think there's a talk on that later in the week. So that's been really great. It's just important to remember we've only scratched the surface of what's possible in large-scale structure. If you just count up the number of modes that we've surveyed in large-scale structure, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what's available. And by tiny, I mean like a part in a million. There's just a huge amount, not even counting 21 centimeters, there's just a huge amount more information out there for us to go and survey. I want to advertise this review article that David Weinberg led a group of us to write. It's a large review of observational methods for study of dark energy. So if you're a grad student or are advising a grad student who's getting started in this field, I think this could be a good compendium for people to look at. And so I'll conclude that acoustic oscillations are providing a robust way to measure the Hubble parameter and angular diameter distance. It's a very clean signature in the clustering of galaxies. It's well protected from low redshift systematics, so it can really do quite well. You can probe to high redshift. You can probe the Hubble parameter directly. So we've been using this in SDSS to measure the distances to redshift 0.35 to just better than 2%, similarly at 0.57, as well as a first detection at redshift 2.3 that Anja's going to tell you about next. This is all given very excellent consistency with flat lambda CDM, but this is really only the start, and large galaxy surveys are going to be pushing to 1% and well below in the coming decade. So thanks very much.
Dan, could you go back a number of slides where you had H-naught slightly lower? I wanted to understand what value of H-naught you used for that.
You're going to have to tell me where to start.
Keep going. Yes, there.
Okay. Yeah.
So what did you assume for H-naught there?
Oh, this is the Reese et al. Sorry, this is the Reese et al.
Just Reese et al.
This is okay. Just Reese et al. Sorry, yeah, you're exactly right to ask. So this is the Reese et al. Point. Of course, the Friedman et al. Point is pretty similar. I think the error bar is slightly larger, but those are two votes in terms of direct measurements of H-naught that are both voting towards 74. If you just extrapolate Planck, I guess you get 67-ish.
Yeah, 68.
So if you were to take BOSS and extrapolate with the supernova, you get numbers of order 70.
Any more questions?
And I'd probably not. This plot is a little bit, can be a little confusing. But although the Planck data here is assuming lambda CDM, the data points in terms of BAO are not assuming lambda CDM. This is assuming the omega matter H squared, that's the sound horizon that's measured at or inferred at redshift of 1,000, but no aspect of low redshift, no assumption about low redshift has gone into how we get these points.
Yeah. So about the reconstruction. You have reconstructions applied to correlation function and power spectrum.
Right.
And then they shift the info distance scales by some different amounts. And you studied whether how that's likely or unlikely given the simulations.
Right.
And you show that they are indeed within say 2 sigma.
Right.
But nevertheless, you know, it's sort of on the tail of distribution. My question would be, so that was applied to this fairly patchy survey configuration of the DR9.
Right.
Now that you have more data, do you see that's getting more consistent, or do you still, well, you cannot really tell?
Okay, so Itro is referring to several different things here, I think. So one thing is that in the DR9 data set, the error bars did not improve as we turn on reconstruction. I think that's consistent with the behavior in the mocks. I mean, most mocks gave an improvement, and so we chose to use the reconstructed version as our preferred version. That said, of order 10% of the mocks didn't show improvement. And I think this is exactly traceable to the fact that the geometry is kind of ugly. I mean, these flows are generated at 50 to 100 megaparsec scales. That's scales of order 5 degrees in our sample. And that means anytime you're within 5 degrees of a boundary, you're getting an incomplete view of what the velocity field ought to be, and we're in the unfortunate case in DR9 that a lot of our volume is within 5 degrees of a boundary. So just not, you know, it worked a lot better in DR7 just because it's a filled region. As you say, as we go to DR10 and build the final data release, that improves. We can already see improvement in DR10, so I think at the level of mocks, yes, that's going the right direction.
What about the
shifting? You then asked a separate question about, or there was another aspect of your question, which was that in our DR9 analysis, the power spectrum and the correlation function gave slightly different answers. Again, I think that was consistent with the mocks. That said, I'm not sure I don't think that was a reconstruction issue. I think that there may be differences in the power spectrum and correlation function analysis that introduce the opportunity for different noise to enter each statistic. So we're looking to see how we can improve these two, or alter these two analysis techniques to try to decrease that scatter. But it's not obvious to me that it's a reconstruction item.
Okay.
In other words, when we, even on the pre-reconstruction data, when you look at the mock catalogs, there's a significant, there was a notable scatter between the power spectrum and the correlation function result. And so I didn't think that actually had gotten all that much worse when we went to reconstruction, or changed that much.
Okay, so as you mentioned, there is a mild tension.
Sure.
I'm here.
Oh, sorry.
There is a mild tension between Planck and SNLS compilation,
yeah.
In particular, in value of omega m. If you look at value of omega m, you see maybe 1 sigma, 1.2 sigma sort of tension. And indeed, when you do this analysis with Planck, it pulls away from w equal to -1.
Right.
And you see that distinctly, which is not the same behavior when you use other compilations like Union 1.2.
Right, I agree.
Which is, yeah. My question is the following. So with this improvement in accuracy, they say you can aim at 1%. Do you think that we can somehow resolve these sort of discrepancies? Will you be able to disentangle these or not?
So, okay, well, first of all, so I think for STSS3,
yes.
Just taking
yes.
that as a peculiar, particular example, so our error bars, we'll improve the error bars here, and we'll improve the error bars here. And the error bars will shrink to slightly smaller than the gray band here, just to give you a visual sense of it. So that helps, but there's not a lot of lever arm between these two. So if you're asking whether we're going to be able to tell the difference between the supernova curve slope and the lambda CDM slope between these two narrow redshift ranges, I think that's going to be hard. I don't know if I can get to the back of this talk fast enough. If you imagine the full, this is now not data, but if you imagine the full, you know, optimistic 30,000 square degrees, you know, Uber survey type of thing, and you ask how much precision can you get from BAO in terms of distance, this is the fractional errors on distance where small errors are up here, so high is good. And you can see these are the predictions. So here's where we are today at low redshift. But as you go to high redshift, there's just a lot more volume. And this, I think, is very indicative of the kind of complementarity between supernova and BAO analyses that we're going to be living with just because of cosmic variance. There's just not that much volume at low redshift to really continue to improve. At high redshift, there's a lot of opportunity. Supernova, on the other hand, if you can do calibration to 1% in flux, then you would be getting error bars like that. And so it really is always going to be the case that at redshifts less than a half, we want to use some non-cosmic variance limited probe to push to low redshift. And the supernovae, of course, are a very good one at that. Maybe we'll just develop others. But the two really work well together. And that's just intrinsic.
So how optimistic are you that we could use the full PFK for cosmology more in the future rather than just BAO, and or do we need to, or is the BAO scale enough?
I think we should be aspiring to do that, absolutely. I focused on BAO here, obviously, and one of the reasons I do that is because scientifically you can get the distance scale. That's very nice. But the other reason is that you get to marginalize against systematic. So the challenge in using the broad bands is understanding galaxy bias. I don't think we should be running in fear about simple nonlinear structure formation. We can run simulations. We can definitely calibrate that part for any particular model you want to run. We'll be able to do that. The challenge is galaxy bias within SDSS and also systematics observationally, which on the largest scales start to limit things. In SDSS3, I don't think we're systematics limited on the large scales at the moment. We do apply some corrections, but they're not particularly nasty corrections. I think that we've done some early work in terms of exploiting the power spectrum. What questions does one want to ask? Well, clearly the Alcock-Pachinsky effect is great if you can do it. You get the Hubble constant more directly. That's wonderful. That can give improvements over what you can get from BAO. We'd love to measure growth of structure because of the tests of modified gravity from there. In terms of monopole shape, if you have really large data sets, Euclid-sized data sets, then one can in principle measure omega matter H squared better than what Planck has determined. So that's an opportunity down the road. But there's also then the interest in neutrinos, because that's an effect that comes in between last scattering and us that produces an extra tilt. So the neutrino work, you benefit from a larger baseline. That's why the Lyman-Alpha-Forest has been active in that field. But in principle, with large surveys such as Euclid, you would like to do that as well. And maybe somebody will dream up other examples. It's certainly the case that the transfer function for large-scale structure and the transfer function for the CMB are different. So if you ever got into a situation where you thought you had a degeneracy between your transfer function and the CMB and whatever thing you were trying to probe in the primordial spectrum, then large-scale structure gets you a different vote.
Okay, I think we need to move on, so let's thank Daniel again.